Move the body. And I didn't see a cell phone. Bosch nodded. Do you know what Mr. Vance hired me to do, he asked. Did he discuss it with you? No, he didn't, she said. Nobody knew. Everybody in the house was curious, but he didn't tell anybody what you were doing. He hired me to find out if he had an heir. Do you know if he had anyone watching me? Why would he do that? I'm not sure. But the will he wrote and had you send to me clearly assumes that I had found a living heir. But we never talked again after that day I visited him at the mansion. Forsythe squinted her eyes, as though she had trouble tracking the story. Well, I don't know, she said. You said you called that number he gave you and left messages? What did you tell him? Bosch didn't answer her. He remembered now that he had left a carefully worded message that could be ascribed to the cover story of finding James Aldridge, but it could also have been taken as a message that Bosch had found an heir. He decided to end the conversation with Forsythe. Miss Forsythe, he said, you should look into hiring an attorney who will represent you in this. It's probably going to get nasty when the will gets filed with the probate court. You need to protect yourself. I'm working with an attorney named Michael Haller. Have whoever you hire contact him. I don't know any lawyers I could call, she said. Ask your friends for a recommendation, or your banker. Bankers probably deal with probate lawyers all the time. Okay, I will. And you never answered about the affidavit. I'll write it up today and bring it back tomorrow for you to sign. Will that be okay?
Yes, of course.
Bosch stood up. Have you actually seen someone watching you or the house?
I have seen cars out there that don't belong, but I can't be sure.
Do you want me to go out the back?
That might be best.
No problem. Let me give you my number. Call me if you have any difficulties or if anybody starts asking you questions.
Okay.
Bosch handed her a business card, and she led him to the back door. Chapter 39. From South Pasadena, it was an easy drive up to the Foothill Freeway, and then west towards San Fernando. Along the way, Bosch called Haller to tell him he had completed both the Cellwright drop-off and the interview with Ida Towns Forsythe. I just left California coding, Haller said. They'll get back to us next week with the results. Bosch realized he was still in the car with Boyd driving and was playing to him, selling the decoy drop of DNA samples. You see any sign of surveillance? Bosch asked. Not yet, Haller said. Tell me about the interview. Bosch recounted the conversation with Forsythe and said he would write up a summary for her to sign the next day. You have a notary you like to use? He asked. Yes, I can set you up or I can witness it myself, Haller said. Bosch said he would be in touch and disconnected. He got to the SFPD station shortly before 4 p.m. He expected the detective bureau to be deserted this late in the day, but he saw the light was on in the captain's office and the door was closed. He leaned his head to the door jamb to hear if Trevino was on the phone, but heard nothing. He knocked on the door, waited, and Trevino suddenly opened it. Harry, what's up? Just wanted to let you know I filed on Dockweiler today. 120 to 160 years in total if he goes down on all charges. That's excellent news. What did they think about our case? Said we're solid. The deputy gave me a list of things he wants me to put together before the prelim, and I thought I'd get started.
Good, good. So it was already assigned?
Yes, Dante Corvallis was in it from the start. He's one of the best. He's never lost a case.
Fantastic.
Well, carry on. I'll be heading home in a few. How's Bella? You go to the hospital today?
I didn't go by today, but I heard she's doing okay.
They said they were going to try to send her home tomorrow, and she's happy about that.
It will be good for her to be with Taryn and her kid.
Yeah. They were both still standing at the door to Trevino's office. Bosch sensed that the captain had more to say, but an awkward silence grew between them.
Well, I've got some stuff to write up, Bosch said. He turned toward his desk.
Harry, Trevino said, you got a minute to come in?
Sure, Bosch said.
The captain stepped back into his office and moved behind his desk. He told Bosch to sit down, and Harry took the one seat available.
This about me using the DMV computer on my private case? He asked.
Oh, no, Trevino said. Far from it. That's water under the bridge.
He gestured to the paperwork on his desk. I'm working on the deployment schedule here, he said. I do the whole department. In patrol we're fine, but in detectives we're not. We are obviously down one with Bella out, and there's no telling at this point when and if she's coming back.
Bosch nodded.
Until that unknown is known, we need to keep her position open, Trevino said. So I talked to the chief about this today, and he's going to go to the city council with a temporary funding request. We'd like to bring you on full-time. What do you think?
Bosch thought a moment before answering. He wasn't expecting the offer, especially coming from Trevino, who had never been sold on Bosch in the first place.
You mean I wouldn't be a reserve? I'd get paid?
Yes, sir. Standard level 3 salary. I know you made more with L.A., but it's what we pay.
And I'd handle all the CAP's cases?
Well, for the most part, I think you'd be doing prep on Dockweiler, and we don't want to forget about cold cases. But yes, when things come up, you'd handle crimes against persons. You'd work with Sisto on those, when you need to go into the field.
Bosch nodded. It was good to be wanted, but he wasn't sure he was ready to commit to a full schedule in San Fernando. He assumed the Vance case and his role as executor of his will would take up a lot of time in the near future, especially with the possible probate battle brewing. Trevino took his silence for something else.
Look, he said, I know you and Sisto had that flare-up in the public works office, but I think that was just a heat-of-the-moment sort of thing. By the time you two were finding and rescuing Bella, it seemed like you were working together well. Am I wrong?
Sisto's all right, Bosch said. He wants to be a good detective, and that's half the battle right there.
What about you?
Was wanting to fire me that night a heat-of-the-moment sort of thing, too?
Trevino raised his hand in a show of surrender.
Harry, you know I've had trouble with this arrangement from the start, he said. But I'll say it. I was wrong. Look at this case, the screen cutter. We got them all because of your work, and I appreciate that. You and I are fine, as far as I'm concerned. And just so you know, this wasn't the chief's idea. I went to him and said I wanted to bring you on full-time.
I appreciate that. So it would mean no more private work, right?
We can talk to the chief if you think you need to keep the private ticket going. What do you say?
Well, what about the sheriff's investigation of the shooting? Don't we need to wait until we get an official decision on that and it goes to the DA?
Come on. We know it was a good shooting. We may get dinged on tactics, but as far as a shoot or don't shoot question, nobody's going to bat a fucking eye. On top of that, everyone understands that Bella's being out puts us in a personnel squeeze, and it's the chief's call.
Bosch nodded. He had a feeling that he could keep asking questions, and Trevino would say yes to anything.
Cap, can I take the night to think about it and get back to you tomorrow?
Sure, Harry. No problem.
Just let me know.
Roger that.
Bosch left the captain's office, closing the door behind him, and moved into his cubicle. His real reason for coming to the station was to use the printer once he had written up the Forsyth affidavit. But he didn't want to start that document with a possibility that Trevino would come out of his office and see what he was doing. So he passed the time until Trevino left by going over the to-do list he had written during the morning's meeting with Dante Corvallis. Among other requests, the prosecutor wanted updated and signed statements from all of Dockweiler's known victims. He added specific questions he needed answered in the statements. These would be entered into the record at the preliminary hearing of the case against Dockweiler and would allow the victims to avoid having to testify. All that was required in a preliminary hearing was for the prosecutor to present a prima facie case that supported the charges. Proving guilt beyond a reasonable doubt was a measure held for trial. The burden of delivering the case at preliminary hearing would rest primarily on Bosch, as he would testify about the investigation that led to Dockweiler. Corvallis said he wanted to avoid, unless absolutely necessary, having to put victims of rape on the witness stand to publicly relive the horror of what had happened to them. He only wanted that to happen once, and that was when it counted, at trial. Bosch was halfway through creating a template of questions to submit to the victims when Trevino left and locked his office after snapping the light off. Okay, Harry, I'm out of here. Have a good night and get some rest. You in tomorrow? Not sure yet. I'll either be here or I'll call you with my answer. Great. Bosch watched over the cubicle wall as Trevino went to the attendance board and signed himself out. The captain didn't say a thing about Bosch having not signed it when he came in. Soon the captain was gone, and Bosch was alone in the bureau. He saved his work on the witness template and opened a new blank document. He then typed out an affidavit, beginning with the words, "I, Ida Towns Forsyth." It took him less than an hour to complete a scant 2 pages of basic facts, because he knew from years of dealing with witnesses, affidavits, and lawyers, that the fewer facts he put into the document, the fewer angles of assault there would be for attorneys from the opposition. He printed 2 copies for Forsyth to sign, one to file with the court, and one to keep in a file containing copies of all the important case documents. While he was at the printing station, he saw a sign-up sheet on the unit bulletin board for sponsors for a bowl-a-thon designed to raise funds for a fellow officer on injury leave. The officer was referred to as 11 David, which Bosch knew was the radio call sign used by Bella Lourdes. The flyer explained that while she would be receiving full pay while on leave, she was expected to incur a variety of extra expenses not covered by the workman's comp and by the department's recently trimmed back medical plan. Bosch guessed that those expenses, most likely related to psychotherapy sessions no longer covered by department-provided insurance. Beginning Friday evening, the bowl-a-thon would go for as long as possible, and the suggested sponsorship was for $1 a game, an estimated $4 an hour. Bosch saw that Sisto was listed on one of the teams. He took a pen out of his pocket and signed his name below Trevino's name on the sponsorship list. The captain had put himself down for $5 a game, and Bosch matched that. Once he returned to his desk, Bosch called Haller. As usual, the lawyer was in the back of his Lincoln, being driven somewhere in the city. "I have the affidavit ready, and can go back at any time you hook me up with a notary," he said. "Good," Haller said. "I'd like to meet Ida, so maybe we all go. What's your 10 o'clock look like tomorrow?" Bosch realized he had failed to ask Forsyth for a phone number. He had no way of contacting her to set up the appointment. He doubted she was listed, considering her job had been working for one of the most reclusive men in the world. "It works for me," he said. "We should meet at her house. I'll get there early and make sure she's home. You bring the notary." "Deal," Haller said. "Email me the address." "Will do. And one other thing? The original docs from the package I received? Do you need them tomorrow or when we go into court?" "No, keep them wherever you have them as long as they're safe." "They are." "Good. We don't want to produce originals until a court orders us to." "Got it." They ended the call. His business finished, Bosch collected the copies of the Forsyth affidavit from the printer tray and left the station. He headed toward the airport over in Burbank, deciding it might be best to make one more change of transportation as he headed into what appeared to be some critical final steps of the Vance case. He pulled into the Hertz return lane, gathered his belongings, including the GPS jammer, and left the Cherokee there. He decided to change things up a little further by going to the Avis counter in the terminal to rent a replacement. While he waited in line to rent, he thought about Forsyth and her accounting of what had transpired in the days following his visit with Whitney Vance. She had a unique view and knowledge of the goings-on inside the mansion in San Rafael. He decided he would prepare more questions for the intended meeting the next day. It was dark by the time he got to Woodrow Wilson Drive. As he rounded the last curb, he saw a car parked at the curb in front of his house, and his headlights illuminated 2 figures sitting inside it, waiting. Bosch drove by while he tried to figure out who it might be, and why they would park directly in front of his house, giving their position away. He quickly came to a conclusion and spoke it out loud. Cops. He guessed they were sheriff's detectives with follow-up questions concerning the Dockweiler shooting. He turned around at the intersection at Mulholland Drive, drove back down to his house, and pulled his rented Ford Taurus into his carport without hesitation. After locking the car, he walked out toward the street to check the mailbox, and to get a look at the sedan's license plate. The 2 men were already getting out of the car. Bosch checked the mailbox and found it empty. "Harry Bosch?" Bosch turned to the street. He didn't recognize either of the men as part of the sheriff's OIS team that had worked the Dockweiler scene the other night.
That's right. What's up, fellas?
In unison, the men produced gold badges that caught the reflection from the street lamp above them. They were both white, mid-40s, and wearing obvious cop suits, meaning off the rack at a two-for-one store. Bosch noticed that one of them carried a black binder under his arm. It was a little thing, but Bosch knew the standard-issue binders used by the sheriff's department were green. LAPD used blue.
Pasadena Police Department, one of them said. I'm Detective Poydras, and he's Detective Franks.
Pasadena, Bosch said.
Yes, sir, Poydras said.
We are working a homicide case, and we'd like to ask you a few questions.
Inside, if you don't mind, Franks added.
Homicide. The surprises kept coming.
A vision of Ida Towns Forsythe's fearful look when she said she was being watched crossed Bosch's mind. He stopped moving and looked at his two visitors.
Who was murdered, he asked.
Whitney Vance, Poydras said.
Chapter 40 Bosch sat the two Pasadena detectives down at the dining room table and took the chair across from them. He didn't offer them water, coffee, or anything else. Franks had been carrying the binder. He placed it to the side of the table. While the two detectives looked to be about the same age, it remained to be seen who had the juice, which one had seniority in the partnership, which one was the alpha dog. Bosch was betting it was Poydras. He was the one who first spoke, and had been behind the wheel of the car. Franks may have been carrying the binder, but those first two facts were clear signs that he was playing second to Poydras. Another was Franks' two-toned face. His forehead was as white as a vampire's, but there was a clear line of demarcation where the lower half of his face was a ruddy tan. It told Bosch that it was likely he frequently played either softball or golf. Since Franks was in his 40s, Bosch guessed it was golf. It was a popular pastime among homicide detectives because it fit with the obsessive qualities needed for the job. But sometimes, Bosch had noticed, golf became a greater obsession than the homicide work. You ended up with guys with two-tone faces playing second string to an alpha dog because they were always thinking about the next round and who could get them onto the next course. Years ago, Bosch had had a partner named Jerry Edgar. He turned Bosch into a golf widow because of his obsession with the game. Once they were working a case and had to go to Chicago to find and arrest a murder suspect. When Bosch got to LAX for the flight, he saw Edgar checking his golf clubs at the luggage counter. Edgar said he was planning to stay an extra day in Chicago because he knew a guy who could get him on to Medina. Bosch assumed that was a golf course. The next 2 days, while looking for their murder suspect, they drove around with a set of golf clubs in the trunk of their rental. Sitting across the table from the two men from Pasadena, Bosch decided it was Poydras who was the dog. He kept his eyes on him. Bosch started with the question before they could. "How was Vance killed?" he asked.
Poydras put an uneasy smile on his face.
"We're not going to do it that way," he said. "We're here to ask you questions, not the other way around."
Franks held up a notebook he had taken from his pocket, as if to show he was there to write information down.
"But that's the thing, isn't it?" Bosch replied. "If you want answers from me, then I want answers from you. We trade."
Bosch waved a hand back and forth between them to signal equal and free trade.
No, we don't trade," Frank said. "One call to Sacramento, and we'd lift your PI license for unprofessional conduct. That's what we do. How would that be?"
Bosch reached down to his belt and pulled his San Fernando badge off it. He tossed it down on the table in front of Frank's.
"It would be okay," he said. "I've got another job."
Franks leaned forward and looked down at the badge, then smirked.
"You're a reserve officer," he said. "You take that and a dollar to Starbucks, and they might give you a cup of coffee."
"I was just offered full-time today," Bosch said. "I'll be getting the new badge tomorrow. Not that what it says on a badge matters."
"I'm real happy for you," Franks said.
"Go ahead and call Sacramento," Bosch said. "See what you can get done."
"Look, how about we stop the pissing match right here?" Poydras said. "We know all about you, Bosch. We know about your LAPD history. We know about what happened in Santa Clarita the other night. And we also know you spent an hour with Whitney Vance last week. And we're here to find out what that was about."
The man was old,
and he was terminal. But somebody sent him to Valhalla a little early, and we're going to figure out who and why. Bosch paused and looked at Poydras. He had just confirmed that he had the juice in the partnership. He called the shots. "Am I a suspect?" Bosch asked. Franks leaned back in frustration and shook his head. "There he goes with the questions again," he said. "You know the drill, Bosch," Poydras said. "Everybody's a suspect until they're not." "I could call my lawyer right now, and that would be the end of this," Bosch said. "Yeah, you could," Poydras said. "If you wanted. If you had something to hide." He then stared at Bosch and waited. Bosch knew Poydras was counting on his loyalty to the mission. He had spent years doing what these two were doing, and he knew what they faced. "I signed a confidentiality agreement with Vance," Bosch said.
"Vance is dead," Franks said. "He doesn't care."
Bosch purposely looked at Poydras when he next spoke. "He hired me," Bosch said. "He paid me $10,000 to find someone for him."
"Who?"
Franks asked. "You know I can keep that confidential," Bosch said, "even with Vance dead."
"And we can throw your ass in jail for withholding information in a homicide investigation," Franks said. "You know you'll beat it, but how long will that take? A day or two in the clink? That what you want?"
Bosch looked from Franks to Poydras. "I'll tell you what," he said. "I only want to talk to you, Poydras. Tell your partner to go sit in the car. You do that, and I'll talk to you. Answer any question. I've got nothing to hide."
"I'm not going anywhere," Franks said.
"Then you're not getting what you came here to get," Bosch said.
"Danny," Poydras said, his head tilted toward the door.
"You're shitting me," Franks said.
"Just go have a smoke," Poydras said. "Cool off."
Franks got up with a huff. He made a show of flipping close his notebook, then grabbed the binder.
"You better leave that," Bosch said, "in case I can point out things at the crime scene."
Franks looked at Poydras, who gave a slight nod. Franks dropped the binder on the table like it was radioactive. He then left through the front door and made sure to slam it behind him. Bosch turned his head from the door to Poydras. "If that was all a good cop, bad cop act, you guys are the best I've ever seen," Bosch said.
"I wish," Poydras said. "But no act. He's just a hothead.
With a 6 handicap, right?"
18, actually. Which is one reason he's pissed off all the time. But let's stay on subject now that it's just us two talking here. Who did Vance hire you to look for?"
Bosch paused. He knew he was on the proverbial slippery slope. Anything he told the police could get out into the world before he wanted it to. But Vance's murder changed the landscape of things, and he decided it was time to give in order to get, with limitations on the give. "He wanted to know if he had an heir," he finally said. "He told me he got a girl pregnant at USC back in 1950. Under family pressure, he more or less abandoned her. He felt guilty all his life about it, and now he wanted to know if she had the baby and whether he had an heir. He told me it was time to balance the books. If it turned out that he was a father, then he said he wanted to set things right before he died."
"And did you find an heir?"
"This is where we trade. You ask a question, I ask a question." He waited, and Poydras did the smart thing.
"Ask your question."
"What was the cause of death?"
"It doesn't leave this room."
"Fine with me."
"We think he was smothered with a pillow off his office couch. He was found slumped at his desk, and it looked like a natural. Old man collapses at his desk. Seen it 100 times before. Only Kapoor at the coroner's office takes the opportunity to grandstand for the media and says there will be an autopsy. He does the cut himself and finds petechial hemorrhaging. Very slight, nothing on the face. Just conjunctival petechiae." Poydras pointed to the corner of his left eye to illustrate. Bosch had seen it in many cases. Cutting off oxygen explodes the capillaries. The level of the struggle and the health of the victim were variables that helped define the extent of the hemorrhaging.
"How do you keep Kapoor from holding a press conference?" Bosch asked. "He needs every bit of positive spin he can get. Discovering a murder written off as a natural is a nice story for him. Makes him look good."
"We made a deal," Poydras said. "He keeps it quiet and lets us work, and we cut him in on the press conference when we break it open. We make him look like a hero."
Bosch nodded approvingly. He would have done the same thing.
"So the case gets kicked over to me and Franks," Poydras said. "Believe it or not, we're the A-team. We go back out to the house. We don't say anything about it being a homicide.
just that we're quality control doing a follow-up investigation, crossing all the T's and dotting the I's. We take a few pictures and make a few measurements to make it look good. And we check the pillows on the couch and find what looks like dried saliva on a pillow. We sample it, get a DNA match to Vance, and now we have the means of murder. Somebody took the pillow, came around behind him in his chair at the desk, and held it over his face. An old guy like that, not much of a struggle, Bosch said. Which explains the lack of obvious hemorrhaging. Poor guy went out like a kitten. Bosch almost smiled at Poydras calling Vance poor. Still, he said, it doesn't feel like something planned in advance, does it? Poydras didn't answer. It's my turn, he said instead. Did you find an heir? I did, Bosch said. The girl at USC had the baby, a boy, then gave him up for adoption. I traced the adoption and identified the kid. Only thing is, he went down in a helicopter in Vietnam a month before he turned 20 years old. Shit. Did you tell Vance that? Never got the chance. Who had access to his office on Sunday? Security people mostly, a chef and a butler type. A nurse came in to give him a course of prescriptions. We're checking them all out. He called his secretary in to write some letters for him. She's the one who found him when she got there. Who else knows what you were hired to do? Bosch understood what Poydras was thinking. Vance was looking for an heir. Somebody who stood to benefit from his death if there was no apparent heir might have stepped in to hasten things along. On the other hand, an heir might also be motivated to hasten the inheritance. Lucky for Viviana Veracruz, she was not identified as a likely inheritor until after Vance was dead. That was a pretty solid alibi in Bosch's book. According to Vance, no one, Bosch said. We met alone, and he said no one was to know what I was doing. A day after I started the job, a security guy came to my house to try to see what I was up to. He acted as though he'd been sent by Vance. I shined him on. David Sloan? Poydras asked. I never got the first name, but yeah, Sloan. He's with Trident. No, he's not with Trident. He was with Vance for years. When they brought in Trident, he stayed on as a guy in charge of Vance's personal security and to liaison with Trident. He personally came to your house? Yeah. Knocked on the door. Said Vance sent him to check on my progress. But Vance told me to talk to no one except the old man himself. So I didn't. Bosch next showed Poydras the card with the phone number Vance had given him. He told the detective that he had called a couple times and left messages, and how Sloan had called him on the number after Vance was dead. Poydras just nodded, taking the information in and fitting it with other case facts. He gave no indication if they had the secret phone and its call records. Without asking if he could keep the card, Poydras put it in his shirt pocket. Bosch, too, was fitting things Poydras had given up with the facts he knew. So far, Bosch felt he had gotten more than he had given, and something bothered him about the new information when it was filtered through the sieve of his existing case knowledge. Something rubbed. He could not quite place what it was, but it was there, and it was worrisome. You looking at the corporate side of this, he asked, just to keep the conversation going while he was grinding on the rub. I told you, we're looking at everybody, Poydras said. Some people on the board have been questioning Vance's competence and trying to oust him for years, but he always managed to carry the votes, so there was no love lost with some of them. That group was led by a guy named Joshua Butler, who will probably become chairman now. It's always a question of who gains and who gains the most. We're talking to him. Meaning they were looking at him as a possible suspect. Not that Butler would have done anything personally, but whether he was the kind of guy who could get it done. Wouldn't be the first time boardroom animosity leads to murder, Bosch said. Nope, Poydras said. What about the will? I heard they opened probate today. Bosch hoped he had slid the question in casually, as a natural extension of the question regarding corporate motivation. They opened probate with a will filed with a corporate attorney back in 92, Poydras said. It was the latest will on record. Vance apparently had his first bout with cancer then, so he had the corporate lawyer create a last will and testament to make the transition of power clear. Everything goes into the corporation. There was an amendment, I think codicil is the word, filed a year later that covers the possibility of an heir. But with no heir, it all goes to the corporation and is controlled by the board. That includes setting compensation and bonus payouts. There are now 18 people remaining on the board, and they're going to control about $6 billion. You know what that means, Bosch.
18 suspects, Bosch said.
Correct. And all 18 of them are well-heeled and insulated. They can hide behind lawyers, behind walls, you name it.
Bosch wanted to know exactly what the codicil regarding an heir said, but thought that if he got more targeted with his questioning, Poggius would start to suspect that his search for an heir didn't end in Vietnam. He thought Haller would at some point be able to procure a copy of the 1992 will and get the same information.
Was Ida Forsyth at San Rafael when you went there to visit Vance? Poggius asked.
It was a turn in direction away from the idea of corporate murder. Bosch understood that a good interviewer never follows a straight line.
Yes, he said. She wasn't in the room when we talked, but she led me back to the office.
Interesting woman, Poitras said. She'd been with him longer than Sloan.
Bosch just nodded.
So have you talked to her since that day at San Rafael? Poitras asked.
Bosch paused as he considered the question.
Every good interviewer sets up a trap door. He thought of Ida Forsyth saying she was being watched, and about Poitras and Frank showing up on the day he visited her, at her home.
You know the answer to that, he said. Either you or your people saw me at her house today.
Poitras nodded and hid a smile.
Bosch had passed the trapdoor test.
Yeah, we saw you, he said, and we were wondering what that was about.
Bosch shrugged to buy time. He knew that they might have knocked on Forsyth's door 10 minutes after he left, and that she could have told them what he had said about the will. But he guessed that if that were the case, Poggius would be coming at the interview from a different angle.
It was just about me thinking she was a nice old lady, he said. She lost her longtime boss, and I wanted to pay my respects. I also wanted to know what she knew about what happened.
Poggius paused as he decided whether Bosch was lying.
You sure that's all it was? He pressed.
When you were standing at the door, she didn't look too happy to see you.
Because she thought she was being watched, Bosch said.
And she was right.
Like I said, everybody's a suspect until they're not. She found the victim that puts her on the list, even though the only thing she gets out of it is being unemployed.
Bosch nodded. He knew at that moment that he was withholding a big piece of information from Poitras, the will he had received in the mail. But things were coming together in Bosch's mind, and he wanted time to think before giving up the big reveal. He changed the subject.
Did you read the letters? Bosch said.
What letters? Poitras asked.
You said Ida Forsyth was called in to write letters for Vance on Sunday.
They never actually got written. She came in and found him dead at the desk. But apparently every Sunday afternoon when Vance was feeling up to it, she came in and wrote letters for him.
What kind of letters?
Business? Personal?
I got the idea it was personal stuff. He was old-fashioned, liked to send letters instead of emails.
Kind of nice, actually. He had the stationery out on the desk, ready to go.
So these were her handwritten letters she was coming in to write for him?
I didn't ask specifically, but the stationery and his fancy pen were there and ready to go. I think that was the plan.
Where are you going with this, Bosch?
You said a fancy pen?
Poggius looked at him for a long moment.
Yeah, you didn't see it? Solid gold pen and a holder on his desk.
Bosch reached over and tapped a finger on the black binder.
You got a photo in there? He asked.
I might, Poggius said.
What's so special about the pen?
I want to see if it's the one he showed me. He told me it was made of gold that his great-grandfather prospected.
Poggius opened the binder and flipped through to a section of clear plastic sleeves containing 8x10 color photos of the Vance death scene. He kept flipping pages until he found a shot he deemed appropriate, and then turned the book around to show Bosch. In the photo, Whitney Vance's body was on the floor next to his desk in his wheelchair. His shirt was open, his ivory chest exposed, and it was clear the photo was taken after unsuccessful efforts had been made to revive him.
Right here, Poggius said.
He tapped the top left side of the photo where the desk was in the background. On the desk was a sheaf of pale yellow stationery that matched the stationery Bosch had received in the package from Vance, and there was a gold pen in a holder that looked like the pen that had also been in the package.
Bosch leaned back and away from the binder.
The pen being in the photo did not make sense, because it had been sent to him before the photo was taken.
What is it, Bosch? Poitras asked.
Bosch tried to cover.
Nothing, he said. Just seeing the old guy dead like that, and the empty chair. Poitras turned the binder to look at the photo himself. They had a house medical officer, he said. I use that term loosely. On Sundays, it was a security guard with EMT training. He conducted CPR but got no response. Bosch nodded and tried to act composed. You said you went back after the autopsy and took more photos and measurements as cover, he said. Where are those photos? You put them in the book? Bosch reached toward the murder book, but Poitras pulled it back. Hold your horses, he said. They're in the back. Everything's chronological. He flipped further into the binder and came to a new set of photos of the office, at almost the same angle, but with no body of Whitney Vance on the floor. Bosch told Poitras to hold on the second photo he turned to. It showed the full top of the desk. The pen holder was there, but not the pen. Bosch pointed it out. The pen's gone, he said. Poitras turned the binder so he could see it better. Then he flipped back to the first photo to make sure. You're right, he said. Where'd it go? Bosch asked. Who knows? We didn't take it. We didn't seal the office either after the body was removed. Maybe your pal Ida knows what happened to the pen. Bosch didn't say how close he thought Poitras was to the truth with that suggestion. He reached over and pulled the binder across the table so he could look at the photo of the death scene again. The appearance and disappearance of the pen was the anomaly, but it was the empty wheelchair that held Bosch's eyes and told him what he had been missing all along. Chapter 41. The next morning, Bosch was sitting in his car on Arroyo Drive by 9:30. He had already called and talked at length to Mickey Haller. He had already been to the evidence lockup at the San Fernando Police Department, and he had already been to Starbucks, where he happened to notice that Beatrice Sahagún was back at work behind the brewer as a barista. He now sat and watched Ida Towns Forsythe's home and waited. He saw no activity at the house, and no indication as to whether she was home. The garage was closed, and the place was still, and Bosch wondered if she would be there when they knocked. He kept his eyes on the mirrors and saw no indications of police surveillance in the neighborhood either. At 9:45, Bosch saw Mickey Haller's town car enter his rearview mirror. He was behind the wheel. He had told Bosch earlier that he had parted ways with Boyd and no longer had a driver. This time Haller got out of his car and came up to sit in Bosch's. He carried his own cup of coffee with him. That was quick, Bosch said. You just breezed into the courthouse and they let you look at the probate file? Actually, I breezed in on the internet, Haller said. All case filings are updated online within 24 hours. The wonder of technology. Not sure my office needs to be in a car anymore. They've closed half the courthouses in L.A. County because of budget cutbacks, and most of the time the internet gets me where I need to go. So the codicil? Your Pasadena police friends were on the mark. The will filed in 92 was amended the following year. The amendment establishes standing for a blood heir should one come forth at the time of Vance's death. And no other will has surfaced. Nothing. So Viviana is covered. She's covered, but with an asterisk. Which is? The amendment grants a blood heir standing as a recipient of a share of the estate. It doesn't specify what or how much the share is. Obviously, when he added this, he and his lawyer both thought that a blood heir was a long shot. They added the codicil just in case. Sometimes a long shot pays off. If this is the will the court accepts, then we would declare Viviana standing, and that's when the fight begins. And it will be a hell of a fight, because it's not clear what she's entitled to. We're going to go in like gangbusters, say she gets it all, and then go from there. Yeah, well, I called Viviana this morning to tell her what was happening. She said she's still not sure if she's up for this. She'll change. It's like winning the lottery, man. Found money, more than she'll ever need. And I guess that's the point. More than she'll ever need. You ever read those stories about people who win the lottery and how it ruins their lives? They can't adjust. They meet people with their hands out wherever they go. She's an artist. Artists are supposed to stay hungry. That's bullshit. That's a myth invented to keep the artist down because art is powerful. You give an artist both money and power, and they're dangerous. Anyway, we're getting ahead of ourselves here. Viviana is the client, and ultimately she makes the call. Our job right now is to put her in the best position to make the call. Bosch nodded. You're right, he said. So you ready to proceed with the plan?
I'm ready, Haller said. Let's do it.
Bosch pulled his phone and called the Pasadena police. He asked for Detective Poitras, and nearly a minute went by before he was connected.
It's Bosch. I was just thinking about you.
Yeah, why's that?
Just thinking about how I know you're hiding something from me.
You got more than you gave yesterday, and that won't happen again.
I don't expect it to.
How's your morning looking?
For you, my morning's wide open.
Why?
Meet me at Ida Forsythe's house in a half hour. You'll get the big give then.
Bosch glanced over at Haller, who was spinning a finger like he was rolling something forward. He wanted more time.
Make it an hour, actually, he said into the phone.
An hour, Poitras said.
This isn't some kind of a game, is it?
No, no game. Just be there. And make sure you bring your partner.
Bosch ended the call. He looked at Haller and nodded. They could expect Poitras in an hour.
Haller grimaced.
I really hate helping the cops, he said. Goes against my religion.
He looked over and saw Bosch staring at him.
Present company excluded, he added.
Look, if all goes well, you get a new client in a high-profile case, Bosch said. So let's go.
They got out of the Ford in unison, Bosch carrying a file containing the affidavit he had printed the day before, and crossed the street toward the Forsythe house.
Bosch thought he saw a curtain move behind one of the front windows as they approached.
Ida Forsythe opened the front door before they had to knock.
Gentlemen, she said, I wasn't expecting you so soon today.
Is this a bad time, Miss Forsythe? Bosch asked.
No, not at all, she said. Please come in.
This time she led the way to the front room. Bosch introduced Haller as the attorney representing a direct descendant and heir to Whitney Vance.
Did you bring the affidavit? Forsythe asked.
Bosch proffered the file.
Yes, ma'am, Haller said.
Why don't you take a few minutes to sit down and read it? Make sure you agree with the contents before you sign.
She took the file to the couch and sat down to read.
Bosch and Haller took seats across a coffee table from her and watched. Bosch heard a buzz and Haller reached into his pocket for his phone. He read a text and then handed the phone to Bosch. The text was from someone named Lorna.
Cal, coding called. Needs new samples. Fire last night destroyed lab.
Bosch was stunned. He had no doubt that Haller had been followed to the lab, and that the fire was an arson designed to thwart the effort to name a DNA-matched heir to the Vance fortune. He handed the phone back to Haller, who had a killer smile on his face, indicating he thought the same as Bosch.
It looks correct to me, Forsythe said, drawing their attention back to her. But I thought you said we would have to have a notary.
I actually am a notary, but I can't witness my own signature.
It's fine, Haller said. I'm an officer of the court, and Detective Bosch is the second witness.
And I have a pen, Bosch said.
He reached into his inside coat pocket and pulled out the gold pen that had belonged to Whitney Vance. He watched Forsythe's face as she recognized the pen he handed her.
They were silent as she signed the document with a flourish, not realizing she was showing her familiarity with using the antique fountain pen. She then capped it, put the document back in the file, and handed both back to Bosch.
It felt strange signing with his pen, she said.
Really? Bosch said. I thought you'd be used to it.
No, not at all, she said. That was his special pen.
Bosch opened the file and checked the document and the signature page. An awkward silence ensued with Haller just staring at Forsythe. She finally broke the sound barrier.
When will you introduce the new will to the probate court? She asked.
You mean how soon will you get your $10 million? Haller asked back.
That's not what I mean, she said, feigning offense. I'm just curious about the process and when I might need a lawyer to represent my interests.
Haller looked at Bosch, deferring the answer.
We won't be filing the will, Bosch said, and you could probably use a lawyer right now, but not the kind you're thinking of.
Forsythe was momentarily stunned.
What are you talking about? She said. What about the heir you found?
Bosch responded in a calm tone that was counterpoint to the rising emotion in Forsythe's voice.
We're not worried about the heir, he said. The heir is covered. We're not filing the will because Whitney Vance didn't write it. You did.
That's preposterous, she said.
Let me lay it out for you, he said. Vance hadn't written anything in years.
He was right-handed. I saw the photos of him signing his book to Larry King. But his right hand had become useless. He didn't shake hands anymore, and the controller on his wheelchair was on the left armrest. He paused there to allow Forsythe to register an objection, but she said nothing. It was important to him to keep this a secret, he said. His infirmities were cause for concern among members of the board of directors. A minority group on the board was constantly looking for reasons to oust him. He used you to write for him. You learned to imitate his handwriting and came in on Sundays when fewer people were around to write his letters and sign documents. That's why you felt comfortable writing the will. If there was a challenge or a handwriting comparison, it was likely that the will would be compared to something else you had written. It's a good story, Forsythe said, but you can't prove any of it. Maybe not, but the gold pen is your problem, Ida. The gold pen puts you in prison for a long, long time. You don't know what you're talking about. I think I want you both to leave now. I know that the real pen, the one you just signed your name with, was in my mailbox at the moment you supposedly found Vance dead. But the photos from the death scene show another pen on that desk. I think you realized that might be a problem, so you got rid of it. It wasn't there when the police went back for round two with the camera. As previously planned, Haller came in at that point to play the big bad wolf. It shows premeditation, he said. The duplicate pen had to be made, and that took time, and planning. Planning means premeditation, and that means life without parole. It means the rest of your life in a cell. You're wrong, Forsythe yelled. You're wrong about everything, and I want you to leave now. She stood up and pointed toward the hallway leading to the front door, but neither Bosch nor Haller moved. Tell us what happened, Ida, Bosch said. Maybe we can help you. You need to understand something, Haller said. You are never going to see a dime of that $10 million. It's the law. A murderer can't inherit from her victim's estate. I'm not a murderer, Forsythe said. And if you won't leave, then I will. She maneuvered around the coffee table and out of the seating arrangement. She headed toward the hallway, intending to go out the front door. You smothered him with a pillow off the couch, Bosch said. Forsythe stopped in her tracks, but didn't turn around. She simply waited for more, and Bosch obliged. The police know, he said. They're waiting out front for you. She still didn't move. Haller chimed in. You go out that door and we can't help you, he said. But there is a way out in this. Detective Bosch is my investigator. If I am representing you, everything we discuss in this room right now becomes confidential. We can work out a plan to go to the police and the district attorney and get the best possible solution. Solution, she exclaimed. Is that your way of saying deal? I make a deal and go to jail? That is crazy. She abruptly turned and charged over to one of the front windows. She split the curtain to look out into the street. Bosch thought it was a little early for the arrival of Poydras and Franks, but knew that the two detectives might already have shown up to see if they could figure out what Bosch was up to. He heard a sharp intake of breath and guessed that the detectives were indeed parked out there, waiting for the appointed time for them to come knock on the door. Ida, why don't you come back and sit down, Bosch said. Talk to us. He waited. He couldn't see her because she had gone to a window behind his chair. Instead, he watched Haller, who had an angle on her. When he saw Haller's eyes start tracking right, he knew she was coming back and that their strategy was working. Forsythe came into Bosch's view and slowly returned to her place on the couch. Her face was distraught. You have it all wrong, she said after sitting down. There was no plan, no premeditation. It was just a horrible, horrible mistake. Chapter 42. Can you be one of the richest, most powerful men on the planet and still be a cheap and petty bastard? Ida Forsythe said it with a distant look in her eyes. Bosch couldn't tell if she was looking at the past or a bleak future, but it was how she began her story. She said that on the day after Bosch visited Whitney Vance, the aging billionaire had told her he was dying. He had taken ill overnight, she said. He looked awful, and he hadn't even gotten dressed. He came into the office around noon in his bathrobe and said he needed me to write something. His voice was barely a whisper.
He told me that he felt like things were shutting down inside, that he was dying, and that he needed to write a new will.
Ida, I told you I'm your lawyer, Haller said. There is no reason to lie to me. If you lie to me, I'm out.
I'm not lying, she said. This is the truth.
Bosch held up a hand to halt Haller from pressing her. Haller was not convinced, but Bosch believed that she was telling the story truthfully, at least from her perspective, and he wanted to hear it.
Tell it, he said.
We were alone in the office, she said. He dictated to me the terms of the will, and I wrote it in his hand. He told me what to do with it. He gave me the pen and told me to send it all to you. Only he left something out.
You, Haller said. All the years I worked for him, she said, at his beck and call, keeping the facade of health intact. All those years, and he wasn't going to leave me anything.
So you rewrote the will, Haller said.
I had the pen, she said. I took some of the stationery home, and I did what was right and deserved. I rewrote it to make it fair. It was so little compared to all there was. I thought...
Her voice trailed off, and she didn't finish. Bosch studied her. He knew that greed was a relative term. Was it greedy after 35 years of service to scheme a $10 million payout from a $6 billion fortune? Some might call it a drop in the bucket, but not if it cost a man the last months of his life. Bosch thought of the flyer for the movie that Viviana Veracruz had put up in the lobby of her building. See this place before the greed. He wondered what Ida had been like before she decided that $10 million was her just reward.
He told me that he had gotten a message from you, she said, beginning what appeared to be a new strand of the story. You said you had the information he was looking for. He said it meant that he'd had a child and there were heirs to his fortune. He said he would die happy. He went back to his room after that, and I believed him. I didn't think I'd ever see him again.
She wrote the will to include herself and put the package in the mail as instructed. She said that for the next 2 days she came to work at the mansion, but she never saw Vance. He was sequestered in his room, and only his doctor and a nurse were granted access. Things looked grave around the mansion on San Rafael.
Everybody was sad, she said. It was clear that this was the end. He was dying. He was supposed to die.
Bosch surreptitiously checked his watch. The detectives out front of the house were going to knock on the door in 10 minutes. He hoped they wouldn't jump the gun and ruin the confession.
Then he called you Sunday, Haller said, trying to keep the story going.
It was Sloan who called, Forsythe said. Mr. Vance told him to call me in. So I got there and he was at his desk, and it was like he had never even been sick. His voice was back and it was business as usual. And then I saw the pen. It was there on the desk for me to write with.
Where did it come from? Bosch asked.
I asked him, she said. He said it came from his great-grandfather. And I said, how can that be? I sent the pen to Detective Bosch, and he said the one on the desk was the original, and what he had given to me to send with the will was a copy. He said it didn't matter because only the ink was important. The ink could be matched to the will. He said it would be providence to help prove the will.
She looked up from the shining surface of the coffee table and directly at Bosch.
He told me then that he wanted me to contact you and retrieve the will, she said. Now that he was better, he wanted to withdraw it and have a lawyer do it formally. I knew if I brought it back to him, he would see what I had done, and it would be the end for me. I couldn't. I don't know what happened. Something broke inside. I picked up the pillow and came up behind him.
She ended the story there, apparently not wanting to repeat the details of the actual murder. It was a form of denial, like a killer covering the face of the victim.
Bosch couldn't decide whether to buy into the confession as full and honest or to be skeptical. She could have been setting up a diminished capacity defense. She also could have been hiding the real motive, that Vance's plan to have a new will written by a lawyer would surely mean the $10 million for her would disappear. Vance is dying at his desk, still gave her a shot at the money.
Why did you remove the pen after he was dead? Bosch asked.
He knew it would be a detail that always bothered him.
I wanted there to be only one pen, she said. I thought if there were two, it would open up a lot of questions about the will you turned in. So after everyone was gone, I went into the office and took the pen.
Where is it? Bosch asked.
I put it in my safe deposit box, she said.
A long silence followed, and Bosch expected it to be broken by the arrival of the Pasadena detectives. It was time. But then Forsythe spoke in a tone that sounded like she was talking to herself, rather than to Bosch and Haller.
I didn't want to kill him, she said. I had taken care of him for 35 years, and he had taken care of me. I didn't go there to kill him.
Haller looked at Bosch and nodded, a signal that he would take it from here.
Ida, he said, I'm a deal maker. I can make a deal with what you just told us. We go in, cooperate, work out a manslaughter plea, and then we shop for a judge sympathetic to your story and your age.
I can't say I killed him, she said.
You just did, Haller said.
But technically you'll just plead nolo in court. You say no contest to the charges. Going any other way is not going to sell.
But what about temporary insanity, she asked. I just lost it when I realized he would know what I had done. I completely blanked out.
There was a calculating tone to her voice now, but Haller shook his head. It's a loser, he said bluntly. Rewriting the will and taking the pen, these are not the steps of an insane person. To make the jump that all of a sudden you lost the capacity to know right from wrong because you feared Vance would find out what you did? In a courtroom I can sell ice to Eskimos, but no jury's going to buy that. He paused for a moment to see if he was getting through to her, then pressed it further. Look, a reality check here, he said. At your age, we have to minimize your time inside. What I've outlined is the way to go, but it's your choice. You want to go to trial on an insanity defense? That's what we'll do. But it's the wrong move. Haller's statement was underlined by the sound of 2-car doors slamming out in the street. Poydras and Franks.
That's the police, Bosch said. They're coming to the door.
How do you want to play it, Ida? Haller asked. Forsythe slowly rose to her feet. Haller did as well.
Please invite them in, she said.
20 minutes later, Bosch stood with Haller on the sidewalk on Arroyo and watched as Poydras and Franks drove away with Forsythe in the back seat of their plain wrap. Speaking of looking a gift horse in the mouth, Haller said, they actually seemed pissed off that we cleared their fucking case for them. Ungrateful bastards. They've been behind the curve on this one since the get-go, Bosch said. And they aren't going to look so good at the press conference when they have to explain that the suspect turned herself in before they even knew she was the suspect. Oh, they'll find their way around that, Haller said. I have no doubt. Bosch nodded in agreement. So guess what, Haller said.
What, Bosch said.
While we were in there, I got another text from Lorna. Bosch knew that Lorna was Haller's case manager. Was it more info on California coding? No. She got the call from Cellwright. There is a genetic match between Whitney Vance and Viviana Veracruz. She's the heir, and in line for a big chunk of money, if she wants it. Bosch nodded. Okay, he said. I'll talk to her and give her the news, see what she wants to do. I know what I would do, Haller said. Bosch smiled. I know what you would do, too, he said. Tell her we could file it as a Jane Doe, Haller said. Eventually, we would have to reveal her to the court and opposing parties, but starting out, we could keep her name out of it.
I'll tell her, Bosch said.
Another option is to go to corporate counsel and lay out what we've got, the DNA, your tracing of the paternal lineage, and convince them, if we get into a fight, we'll take it all. Then we negotiate a nice settlement from the estate and we go away, leaving money and the corporation on the table.
That's an idea, too. A real good idea, I think.
You can sell ice to Eskimos, right? You could get this done.
I could.
The board of directors will take that deal in a heartbeat. So you talk to her and I'll do some more thinking on it. They checked both ways before crossing the street to their cars.
So are you going to work on Ida's defense with me, Haller asked?
Thanks for saying with me, and not for me. But I don't think so, Bosch said. I think I just quit being your investigator on this one. I'm taking a full-time gig with San Fernando PD.
You sure about that?
Yeah, I'm sure.
Okay, my brother from another mother. Keep in touch about that other thing.
Will do. They parted ways in the middle of the street. Chapter 43 Bosch hated the Ford he was driving, He decided it was time to go back to LAX and retrieve his own car after several days of vehicular subterfuge. From South Pasadena, he took the 110 down through the center of the city, past the towers of downtown, and past USC in the neighborhood where Vivian